The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. And one of the secrets to life is to enjoy and to love a whole variety of things. Nothing keeps the wolf away, the emotional wolf away, as well as having a lot you like to do and letting yourself love what you do. This weekend, I got to garden. I got to get my shears out and get my clippers out and take a bunch of bushes that had grown together and to shape them and model them so that you could see each of them in their own unique splendor. And then to sit down and look at what I'd done. And also to look at the huge pile of cuttings that I had created. Love of life, love of what we do, and finding things we love to do and people we love to be with is at the core of the good life. And it's not necessarily an easy thing. We may have to overcome blocks and inhibitions and guilt, shame, and anxiety. But we should never forget the goal. We should never forget that the goal is to embrace life, to engage life, to love life, from the birds and the bees to husbands and wives and friends, to activities, to writing or painting, to working, to seeing a job well done, to sitting down with satisfaction, to appreciate a job well done. If we don't have a concept of loving life to begin with, we don't have that concept, then it's very confusing what we're doing. It's very confusing what we're all about, why we're trying so hard, and why we're struggling. My guest today is someone who I think knows something about this. It's my friend, Gerald Porter, PhD. He's in the field of counseling and education, and he's Dean of the School of Natural Arts and Sciences, Dean of the School of Natural Arts and Sciences at Bastyr University near Seattle. Bastyr is spelled B-A-S-T-Y-R. My understanding is that it's the best and the largest and one of the oldest schools of natural arts and sciences, and basically the natural approaches to healing in the country. I met Jerry when he was chair of the Department of Counseling and Psychological Services at SUNY Oswego. I had known the previous chairman and had taught there. And when Jerry came in, it was just a pleasure to find someone who had an awareness of my work and whom I liked so very, very much. And so I started teaching another time. Now Jerry's gone, but I'm still there. I'm still going to teach every semester at SUNY Oswego. This coming semester, I'll teach a course in empathic therapy. And I'll be teaching a course in critical psychology. Now, Jerry's background before going into academia, he was more nuts and bolts, I presume, working in the New York State government. He worked there on a policy level in education. He worked in corrections and even in economic development. And his research interests he describes as being in this social construction of race, gender, and psychiatric disorders. Jerry Porter, my friend, welcome to the show.
Well, it's a delight to be here, Peter. Thank you for that very nice introduction.
Oh, it's good just to hear your voice. I told Jerry that this was going to be a hard show for me because his voice is so much better than my voice. Have you ever had your own radio show, Jerry? Have you ever been on the radio much?
Well, as it happened, you know, in days long gone by, I used to be a disc jockey.
Oh, my God, I forgot that.
I was on the radio, yeah, down in the Caribbean.
Oh, my God. How interesting. How long did you do that for?
Oh, a couple of years, down in St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's amazing. How did you end up with that kind of a foothold in such a beautiful place?
Well, you know, at that stage of my life, you know, I was just kind of knocking around trying to answer the age-old questions of the meaning of life, and so that had led me down there. So, like you say, apparently I have a pretty good voice, and so I was able to get a job.
So listen, you've opened it all up. What is the meaning of life? Come on, what is the meaning? I actually tried to approach the meaning of life for a few minutes at the start of the show. Was I getting near to it?
Peter, actually, I think you came amazingly close. You know, it's the challenge with the question of the meaning of life is you can never quite put into words what one might come to intuitively know, and that's really one of the challenges. You know, I really think of it as the challenge of being, is that, you know, we're confronted with this amazing fact that we exist, and what do we do with that? How do we make significance of that? And you know, I think that the naive assumption that some folks make is that it's a given, and to some extent it is perhaps given by the conditions in which we find ourselves. But I think for the most part, meaning is something that we have to make and construct for ourselves, and within the parameters in which, you know, we find ourselves. So a great place to start is asking yourself, you know, how can I have a life that I find enjoyable, meaningful, rewarding, and then systematically thinking about making that happen.
And finding also, it's an outward and an inward. You have to look outward at the things you love and enjoy and that turn you on, that grab you. And you also have to look inward to who are you and what are you good at and what do you really care about?
Yes.
What is it you most love?
Yeah. You know, there's a kind of dualism in being human, and you know, part of it is that outward side, but the other part is the inward side, and where I think living becomes really an art form is when we learn to reconcile those two. You know, we learn to integrate that, and but this question of being, of really being present in the moment and not caught up and completely absorbed and identified with that internal monologue that inevitably drones on in the background, I think is one of the first and most powerful things that we can do to really begin to discover the natural joy that life has to offer.
I like that. I like the idea of setting aside that dreary internal monologue.
Mm-hmm.
We used to call them tapes, remember, back in the 60s?
Yeah.
We all had these tapes playing in our head.
Yeah.
And we do. We have these internal monologues, dialogues, maybe even multilogues going on in our heads.
Yes.
And it's a miracle to find ways to set them aside and to be in the moment, to be in the flow is another expression in psychology,
mm-hmm.
to really, and to find relationships in a life that enable us to do that, that encourage us to do that, rather than constantly abusing us, hitting us on the head, and forcing us back into that monologue or dialogue again. Jerry, how did you end up going to Bastyr, going to a university that that is on the edge in many ways of healing, coming out of the establishment of counseling and education? And what does it mean about what's important to you?
Well, you know, I've always been concerned with what are the things that we need to have a good life. You know, I think those of us who have been attracted to mental health have been concerned with the question of the good life, because when you're working with clients, one of the things that you're constantly having to consider and to weigh is, how can I help this client not just adjust to the circumstances in which they find themselves, but how can they really have a more meaningful, richer, enjoyable, rewarding life, which may be something which goes way beyond the conditions that they immediately find themselves. Often, indeed, it is. So for me, a place like Bastyr, which is concerned with natural health, arts and sciences, was a natural. And to be perfectly honest with you, although I'm a guy who has always worked pretty much within the sort of established order, I've always had a deep appreciation for complementary and alternative medicine, for alternative perspectives on, well, just about everything, I guess, because, you know, I think that in many ways the culture of the society in which we live has a lot of growing and development to do. Let's frame that constructively and positively. You know, I want to do what I can to help bring about that. And also, you know, as an educator and a counselor, psychologist, I've always been interested in helping young people grow and develop them, so on. So this year seemed like a great move for me, and it certainly has been.
One of the things that's always interested me is kind of having a sense of what alternative methods are useful, which of them are flaky or have no basis at all, whether methodology, whether it's therapy or something else, should conform to some sort of scientific model. What kind of issues do you get into when you're dealing with this at Bastyr?
Yeah, that's an excellent question.
Not to put you on the spot.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Peter.
I said not to put you on the spot, which I'm doing.
No, that's okay. Well, you know, I think that we do want to have methods that are scientifically grounded, that are evidence-based. And I think at Bastyr, one of the things that the institution prides itself on is that we train students in evidence-based practice. So, but nevertheless, that's consistent philosophically with the ideas of complementary and alternative medicine. You know, the challenge is the scientific establishment has uncritically accepted certain assumptions which are not absolutely necessary to having a good and rigorous methodology for discerning the best practice, but nevertheless are operative. And so the kind of thing I'm talking about, the kind of underlying assumptions that are often so frequently a part of science, but nevertheless not necessarily a part, and I think we can use these to differentiate good practice from bad practice, is this idea of biological causation. You know, everything, all kinds of behaviors that we observe in people don't necessarily have a completely biological cause, even if they're expressed through a biological medium. And this idea of reducing everything to material terms, I think is problematic. The tendency to objectify people and their behavior, I think is deeply problematic, especially in human services, where what we need to do is to affirm the value of persons and individuals rather than to diminish that. And for example, in psychology, the prevailing views, the prevailing paradigm has been that of behaviorism and it's sort of like newer cousin, cognitive practice. And although there's a lot to be said for cognitive practice, behaviorism, if you really take it to its logical extreme, utterly denies the value and the meaning of the person. It says that there really isn't anybody there, that the behaviors that are manifest, which is the only thing that we attend to, are merely shaped and conditioned by external circumstances. And so that kind of a model leaves nothing for a person to be recognized and affirmed. I think when we look at different kinds of practices, we need to see, on the one hand, does it have a good, rigorous model for evaluating factual information, for evaluating experiences and phenomena that occur in the material world, but at the same time recognizes that there's a whole lot more going on than just that stuff, and that we need to have methodologies for accessing, understanding, and evaluating. What we were talking about earlier is that those inner dimensions, the emotional, and even what might be characterized as a spiritual, or what I would use the language integral. It's not easy. It's not easy. And I think one of the things that's happening today is we have, an emerging paradigm, emerging alternatives. And as a society, we're going to have to figure out which of these emerging paradigms are we really going to recognize and acknowledge, and who are we going to be in this new century? What story are we going to tell ourselves about who we are? What's our new mythos?
That's one of the reasons that Ginger and I decided to break with our old organization and start the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, Education, and Living, because we really believe that people need to come together around a new concept of what it is to be a human being, to have a good life, and to move it away from the medical model, and to draw in a wide variety of people, somewhat in the same way, but not exactly the same way, that I think at your university you're trying to draw people together. From my audience, just to let you know, Jerry Porter, whom I'm talking to, is on our advisory council and was probably the first or second person I asked to join, and did readily join, and gave a marvelous talk at the conference. I had him speak right after me to sort of give a really good introduction to the breadth of what we're trying to do. And I'll be coming out and talking at Bastyr sometime, probably in February, you're thinking, Jerry?
Yeah.
Sometime in February or March?
Yes. We're very excited about that. Let me just tell people in your audience what a wonderful idea, what a wonderful notion empathic therapy is, because it really is affirming so many of the things that have been devalued and ignored in our society of late. And the wonderful thing about it is it's much more straightforward, and it's much less costly, and it's something that, in line with what we said already, really affirms the person, both the person who is struggling with adjustment issues and problems, and the folks who want to help them. It keeps people on much more of an even, equal keel. So I just think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing, and I'm very supportive of the work that you and Ginger are doing.
One of the things I would love to find a way to do, and I'm talking to psychiatrists in the third world nations, we used to call them, I guess we call them developing nations now, about how easy it would be to train people to be good therapists without any other education. People who would maybe graduate high school, maybe not. If you used your criteria for a therapist as being a good, solid human being who is responsible and cares about other human beings, a good, solid person, responsible and cares about other human beings, reasonably intelligent, really basics, we could train therapists without regard for their education or their age, in special programs where we just gave them certificates, and they could do really good therapy and charge very little compared to the prevailing rates. The problem would be that there'd be such resistance from all the formal training groups, the social workers, the psychologists, the counselors, the marriage and family counselors. They would all come down hard on the idea of setting aside whether you got a BS degree or a BA degree, let alone an MSW or a PhD, and just concentrated on the person, the kind of person we want to do therapy. And then the training people, and that could be done, I think, in a year of really good, solid work to train someone to really help other human beings. Do you think there's any hope for anything like that in America, Jerry?
Well, there's always hope. I think your thought that the place to start would be the developing world, where the powers that be are less entrenched, and there's a recognition in many developing countries that, you know, we need to do something to get help out to people who are really struggling and coping with, you know, all these problems. Of course, one of the issues in the developing world is that the incidence of some of the extreme psychiatric disorders is lower, precisely because of the conditions that, you know, that exist in those countries. So I think that there is real hope for that kind of a model. And, speaking of that, SUNY Oswego had a project in Haiti where they were working with community leaders and doing very much the same thing you just described, where they were training community leaders in how to cope with some of the more, well, the symptoms of post-traumatic stress in the wake of the terrible earthquake that struck Port-au-Prince. I think that kind of model, also working with indigenous practitioners in developing countries who already have the trust of the community and often have many of the skills that you outlined of, you know, being able to listen, being compassionate, being present. I think there's hope. Once it's successful in the developing world, then I think we can ask ourselves, well, if it's been so successful here and it's been such a low-cost phenomena, why can't we bring that and import that here and make that a part of our system? Of course, I think we're rapidly moving towards becoming the developing country. That's another story.
Well, yeah, that is another story and a scary story, and I certainly am in agreement with you about that danger. One of the things we learned about third world countries with repeated studies out of the World Health Organization is that people who do have acute psychotic breaks that would get labeled schizophrenic in the industrialized nations actually do better in the third world nations, and they do better for two reasons. One, they don't get Western psychiatric care with the drugs that inhibit mental development, suppress emotionality, and estrange people from their spirituality. They simply don't get the oppressive drugs that they get in this country. And when they do get them, they're not supervised as carefully, and they just stop taking them. So it was the absence of Western psychiatry and the presence of extended family, the presence of people to bring you back to the reality of human life, because being psychotic and schizophrenic is basically being alienated from other human beings, being terrified of them, losing all trust in other human beings, losing faith in your ability to relate to people. That's at the core of what we call schizophrenia and psychosis of various kinds. And it would be really wonderful to take that basic principle of the importance of extended family and basically train folks even more to be counselors in the communities. And of course, they're going to need that more in the third world or the undeveloped, the less developed, the developing nations, whatever ugly term we find for it. It's going to be needed more as they become more like us. They're going to have more need for people to step into the empty spaces created by industrialization and people moving into the cities and losing some of their family structure. Jerry, do you want to tell us more about Bastyr and tell people the kinds of programs that you have there now?
Well, Bastyr really started as an institution to train naturopathic physicians, and we certainly continue to do that, but we also have programs in acupuncture and oriental medicine. We have within the School of Natural Health Arts and Sciences at Bastyr, we have counseling and health psychology. We have a very novel program that combines training in nutrition and counseling that leads to licensure as a counselor in the state of Washington, and of course, I think by reciprocity, most other places. We have a very
Is that a master's program, Jerry?
That's a master's program, yep. Yes.
Okay.
We have a Master of Science in Midwifery, and it's a very interesting program because it allows for people to enter the program as undergraduates and complete their undergraduate work and then move directly into the Master of Science program. And it's the nation's first regionally accredited direct entry articulated Master of Science in midwifery. So, you know, we're very, very proud of that. We have programs in nutrition and exercise science. We have the Simkin Center. The Simkin Center for Allied Birth Vocations. They train doulas. People probably may not be aware of what a doula is, but a doula is a woman who provides support to expectant mothers, and then also provide support, emotional support, and material support in the sense of, you know, just helping with all the things that are necessary when you have a newborn enter your life, or expecting a newborn to enter your life. So we have training programs for birth doulas and for postpartum doulas. We have training programs for childbirth educators, for educators in breastfeeding and lactation, for in pre- and perinatal massage therapy, in infant massage. And the Simkin Center, interestingly enough, was founded by a woman in the Pacific Northwest of Seattle area here called Penny Simkin. Really has done so much to professionalize this these natural birth arts and sciences, and to really create doulas as a profession. And research shows that that women who have doulas have many fewer low birth weight babies. It increases the survival statistics. It's a really positive, less postpartum depression. And this is empirically documented. And of course, traditional societies just sort of naturally provided that, but in our society, that's been less common. And so this is a role we think can really make a difference in, for families and for women. So that's some of the programs that we have. We have some bachelor's programs in psychology, in integrated human biology, in exercise science and wellness, in nutrition, in herbal science. You know, we like to think of ourselves as being the premier institution for complementary and alternative medicine. Lots of other great institutions, but I do think there's something very special about this deer.
I can't wait to come out there and meet your colleagues and spend some time there. I think this would be a good time for a break, I'd like to move in that direction, Katie, if we can. And Jerry, when we come back, see what you'd like to continue talking about.
Great.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
To the number one internet radio station for progressive minds, Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Hi, this is Karen Hartglass, and I am a vegan. No, I am not an alien from planet Vega. I simply choose to eat plant-based foods. Join me on Ask a Vegan every Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll be talking about everything from soup to nuts. Plant-based foods are the healthiest foods to eat, as well as being the most economical, the most compassionate, and the least destructive. If you want to know more about the healthy, planet-friendly, plant-based diet, call in with your questions. Or call in and share your favorite vegan recipes. Tune in on Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on www.progressiveradionetwork.com.
Hello, I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency, connecting people, ideas, important information, nurturing human renaissance, seeking to transform disintegrating empire into healthy, problem-solving, creative, evolutionary, peaceful communities. To hear us, listen every Thursdays, 5 to 6 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network.
Progressive Radio Network, the number one radio station for progressive minds.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I'm talking with my friend, and scholar, Jerry Porter. Dr. Porter is the dean of the School of Education. No, I'm sorry. That's from the past. He's the dean of the School of Natural Arts and Sciences at Bastyr University. And again, Bastyr is B-A-S-T-Y-R. And it's an astonishing place. I'm going to be going out there. We'll post it eventually when we know the dates to give a talk. Jerry, you're near Seattle?
Yes. We're in Kenmore, Washington, which is on the beautiful shores of Lake Washington. We're right next to a beautiful state park, St. Edward State Park. So it's a lovely pastoral location with towering evergreens. So people are certainly welcome to come. And we, by the way, we have a fantastic cafeteria with a brand new chef who is inspired. And so
that would be amazing at a university.
It is. It's quite remarkable. Quite remarkable.
The counseling that you teach, is it very similar, do you think, your department and what it's doing to, say, the department at SUNY Oswego or other good academic departments around the country, or is it got a little something special in terms of the orientation of your school?
Well, I think it's very similar in terms of the basic skills and practices that are part of counseling as a discipline. The thing that's distinctive about the master's level program that we currently have is that it does combine counseling with an understanding of nutrition, so that's very novel. And we're just beginning to, I guess it's premature to say that we're at this point, but we are going to be expanding our offerings in mental health. You know, I think what's different about programs that we have in counseling and psychology at Bastyr as opposed to so many other places, I mean, almost everybody has programs in psychology, but at Bastyr, those philosophical differences just permeate the atmosphere. So, you know, that sense of the underlying value and worth of the person, that sense of the underlying unity and connectedness of everything, you know, a complete embrace of the spiritual without, but in a broad sense, so that it's inclusive and encompassing, you know, that recognition of the value of relationship and affirming that. Not that other places don't do that, but I think there's a deeper commitment to that in a way that challenges some of the prevailing mores of the dominant culture.
Do you have PhD programs?
We don't right now. You know, I'm hoping in the near future we will have something, so it would be premature for me to say anything, but certainly it's my hope that we will have something in the not-too-distant future along those lines.
God, we are so in need of a really humanistic, spiritual, all the things you're saying, PhD program in psychology and clinical psych. I mean, it is so – people get in touch with me all the time and want to know where they can get a PhD in psychology or a closely related field that isn't going to be totally offensive to the best principles of human life. And it would be, yes. God, I'd just love to see you do something like that.
Yeah. Well, me too. Me too. Yeah.
Well, if the opportunity comes up, I'd raise my hand to do distance teaching to help in a program like that. That would be a miracle.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that, you know, I would just like to mention, and some of my research has been in this area, and that is this idea of what I call deep diversity, and the challenge of being. And You know, normally or typically when people talk about diversity, they're talking about cultural, racial, ethnic, religious differences. And of course, those are very real and meaningful differences that exist between people and something that we need to understand. But deep diversity, I think, really takes it to a more profound level and really asks, when people construct their experience, when they construct their reality, and that's something I just want to say a little something about, is that, you know, so often people naively assume that what they experience is what's absolutely real, and I think it's important to understand that our experience is something that gets constructed in our nervous system. And so, you know, the stories that we tell ourselves, the conditioning that we've had in the past really shape how that virtual reality, if you will, that's embedded within our nervous system, that plays out in our nervous system, is experienced. And so, you know, deep diversity really means that we become aware of and start to think very consciously about what's the programming that has, that this virtual reality that we're experiencing, this experience of self that we have, this experience that we're having is constructed on? What are the underlying assumptions? And, you know, earlier we were talking about the problematic assumptions that often the scientific establishment has, you know, materialism, reductionism, biological causation, and so on. And so I think it's just very important to be aware of this fact that we are constructing our experience and that it's based on those tapes that we're playing, you know, to use the language we talked about earlier. And that's something that people can learn to control, that people can really understand, it's the easiest and cheapest and most powerful form of self-help, I think, that's available, is to begin to be able to observe yourself and see the behavior, the emotionality that you're experiencing, the kind of cognition, the kind of thoughts that go through your head, and begin to become aware of, well, what is it that's driving that? What's making that happen? And one of the things that I found in working with clients is that at first I started trying to root out what are these core assumptions, and then we'll shift these assumptions. And that had a certain degree of success. And then I actually found something that was really much more powerful, at least I believe it was much more powerful, and that was to really have people begin to move their attention away from that internal monologue, dialogue, what have you, and begin to direct that attention just on their physical presence, just on being present in the present moment. And I found that that's incredibly powerful and transformative and healing, and that when you're able to live in that space, there's a natural sort of spontaneous joy which can begin to emerge, and it's just extremely, extremely powerful. And it that's not to say that one shouldn't go back and try to work through and understand the kind of conditioning and the factors that have shaped our lives and deepen our self-understanding. But at the same time, I think the most powerful tools that are available to us, as you've articulated in empathic therapy of relationship and caring and so on, it requires just really doing that. It requires engaging in that. And I've just been struck with the transformative power of such simple interventions as just really being present in the present moment.
You're listening to my friend Jerry Porter talking about really the frontiers of counseling and of self-help and of helping other human beings. There are so many different approaches that fall under this rubric I'm calling empathic therapy. And by the way, Jerry's referred a couple of times to something that we haven't made explicit. He's referring to the Guidelines for Empathic Therapy, which appears on the website empathictherapy.org. So go to empathictherapy.org and you can find the Guidelines for Empathic Therapy. And I worked those up with input from a number of the advisory council members, including Jerry. It's something of a group effort, although certainly ultimately I'm taking responsibility for it. And it attempts to kind of get at this umbrella of looking at the human being in a positive, nurturing, loving, engaging, personal, interpersonal, maybe transpersonal manner. And that's just going to vary so much from counselor to counselor. But what is important, most important, is this recognition that the pathological model has limited service. The way it's constructed in psychiatry and the DSM-4, I believe it's almost wholly destructive. There are purposes, however, to going back and understanding the psychology, the dynamics, the tapes, the monologues inside your head and where they came from, how they harm. But ultimately, there's got to be this larger idea that human beings can thrive. They can thrive by being in the moment, as Jerry has been describing. They thrive through prayer. They thrive through relationship with God, through relationships with each other, through many different ways that expand our consciousness, expand our ability to relate, expand our ability to care and to create. Without that, therapy is either limited or doomed. And with it, therapy and also our approach to life has really no limit to it, because we're each so creative in our own way, and then so creative when we work with others and hear from others and give to others. We can't help other people simply on the basis of getting over problems, getting over emotional blocks, getting over overwhelming guilt, shame, and anxiety. The getting over in itself has to involve a moving to a new and better place. So whatever your orientation as a patient, a client, or a therapist and a helper, you need to bring your whole self to the process. And you need to believe that the process involves a real growing of yourself as client, as therapist, a constant growing and maturing in new directions as you go through life. Jerry, thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I completely agree with what you said. You know, one way of thinking about this, I've recommended that everybody have some kind of integral practice, whether it be meditation, prayer, some kind of body work, you know, Tai Chi, even martial arts, I think, can fill this function to some extent. But you know, it's a kind of practice which grounds the person in presence. It deepens them, and so much of that healing and transformative process is getting that stuff that's buried inside up to the surface and exposed to the light of day. And to have that as a daily practice, I think, makes a huge difference. So, yes, I think that's one of the most powerful ways that we can learn to live fully, really be a whole person, is to have something that takes the shadow and begins to expose it to the light of day, that unburies those things, peels away the onion skin so that we can see and experience, not necessarily consciously, but we can make that connection in terms of presence and being.
What are your most important projects now for yourself? Is that too big a question or too personal a question?
Well, for myself right now, I'm very much caught up in my work here at Bastyr, trying to develop new programs that are going to do just exactly what you described so eloquently a moment ago, which is to help people be complete and full persons, and to heal and to make people whole. So, I think, the old adage, physician heal thyself, I think practitioners need to first go through some kind of process of healing themselves so that they know that of which they speak, and they can draw not only on their technical and expert knowledge, but also on that first-hand direct knowledge that they have. So I've been very much involved with program development here at Bastyr. We've got some exciting programs. For example, one area that I think has enormous promise, and that is to reintegrate and revision traditional psycho-spiritual systems that I think have an enormous amount to offer us, but have not been understood to fit into and have a place in an evidence-based, science-based kind of approach. And that's kind of what I mean by deep diversity. Deep diversity is we have to find some way to let everybody be at the table and have a meaningful discourse about how do we forge ahead in our life together on spaceship Earth? And one of the programs here at Bastyr that I think we really have a pioneering effort on is one in, we've called it a number of different names, but Indigenous Studies, which is really looking at indigenous practice from the psycho-spiritual systems that have prevailed in the developing world, everything from Santeria, voodoo, whatever. And I mean, just to say those words evokes a certain sense of, this is something unscientific and problematic to look at Native American practices. But I think we need to find some way to reintegrate the incredible wisdom that these traditional practices have into our evidence-based approaches. And so we've actually been reconceptualizing the Indigenous Studies program to one of contemplative studies, which would include those traditional kinds of practices, but really have strands along meditation, body work and movement practices, even energy practices. So, I think that's very cutting edge. But I also think it's exactly the kind of thing which is helping to redefine the boundaries of legitimate practice in the new century.
I think it's very, very exciting. It's some of it's, in a sense, ahead of what I'm thinking about. Which is good. A lot of the people I work with are thinking ahead of where I am in one area or another, and that in itself is exciting. That and I think this is what we need. Human nature and human life is so complicated. It's so beyond any one of us.
Yes.
It's so beyond any one of us that, Lord, we need all of us. And we need so many different ways of thinking about it. And I love your openness the whole range of the way people seek healing. I think it's absolutely marvelous. I think Bastyr is very fortunate to have you, and I hope that your university and your program is going to become more and more the place to go in my area of psychotherapy and counseling. I hope it'll become just more and more that your programs will become known as the one place where you can go and really learn with guidance to become the kind of therapist or counselor you want to become. I think your place, Bastyr, has the potential, and your program has the potential to be the place right now.
Well, thank you, Peter, and I share that opinion, and I'm really excited about the possibilities of what can happen here at Bastyr. But more important and perhaps more pertinent is this: really excited about the possibilities for healing. You hear so much negative stuff about what's happening in the world these days, but I think there are many wonderful things that are happening, and it's possible for individuals to make a difference. And one of the best ways to do that, I think, is in healing practice, mental health, or otherwise.
I think so, and I think it should be deeply connected to morality and deeply connected to ethics. And to a great extent, the way the world changes for the better is by greater numbers of people being devoted to living responsible and loving lives and being open to other human beings and their approaches to life, providing that freedom is respected, that people take responsibility for themselves, that we have a loving attitude toward life and whatever our spiritual concept of the universe is. And there's no way around the fact that it's individuals that will make the change. Without individuals, no top-down change in the world is going to work. The American Revolution was a revolution that came from people changing their ideas about how they wanted to live and about freedom and about responsibility. And the founders knew so very, very well that it was this enlightened citizenry that was the bedrock of any kind of society. And I can't say enough about that importance. And I like your emphasis on the individual and on change in the individual, even as we change each other and help each other grow.
Yes.
We got about 2 minutes left. Any parting thoughts? Any summary of what you're thinking and what you'd like to leave folks with?
Well, you know, along the lines of what you just said, is I think that one of the big problems is just that individuals need to be engaged. They need to know that it's possible that they can change their lives. They can change their lives for the better. That happiness and satisfaction and meaning is a real possibility. It's not only a possibility; it's our birthright. And no matter how bad things seem to be in the larger world, it's possible to find that. And if individuals find that, I believe that the world will be transformed. That the larger world, I think, is really just a reflection, a projection, if you will, of what's happening in the soul. And so, every time I've had a successful therapy, I've become extremely impressed by the possibility for growth and change, even when things seem like, at least initially, that's not possible. So.
Jerry, thank you so much. You and I are so much on the same page. The lesson is to live life to the fullest. Don't drug yourself. Don't give yourself one of those crappy old diagnoses. Really learn who you are and grow to the maximum in every spiritual, psychological way that you can. That is what life is about. Thank you very much, Jerry, for being on the show.
Thank you.
Listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.